Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to boxer Mary Kate Slattery.
I remember even one day, this is probably, I'd say maybe a year on from the diagnosis, coming down the stairs from school, and like in the, you know, the parents would all be standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I kind of walked down and I was like, "Mum," like waving at her, and she was looking over me. She didn't recognize me. You know, I was so gaunt and just really just lost. Like I wasn't there. So I remember that, my mum kind of looking over me and not recognizing me, and the other parents, you know, just horrible, horrible stuff. Sorry, I'm getting a bit sad thinking about it. But sure, listen, the way I think about it now is it's important to tell the story because I got the help that I needed. Yeah. And so many people don't. Mm. So many people live with it, you know, or can recover like 75% and still have that controlling part of their mind, you know. And like, I just feel so passionately about people can recover fully and take their lives back and just become themselves again.
Originally from Dublin, Mary Kate spent parts of her childhood in Lahinch in County Clare. She's the eldest of three girls, a law graduate from Trinity College Dublin, and when she was only 9, she developed anorexia. She spent time in and out of Crumlin Children's Hospital, but eventually had to go to London to receive treatment at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children. In this conversation, we speak about her battle with anorexia, perfectionism, therapy, meditation, femininity, letting go, and her love of boxing. It's an important yet challenging conversation in parts, so please check the show notes before you listen. And I started by asking her about developing anorexia.
Yeah, at age 9, I started to develop anorexia. I was diagnosed in November 2006. I was 10 years old. But it really started to develop around May 2006. My aunt passed away. Mm. And at the time, I think you could pinpoint that as one of the main triggers. I didn't know how to process grief. I didn't know how to, you know, I didn't know how to mourn, I guess. And
you were very close to her?
Very close to her, yeah. She had no kids. She was like a second mother. She was with us all the time. She lived down the road. She was one of the, I'd say, my first idol. Okay, just an incredible woman, worked in the Department of Foreign Affairs, was, you know, she was like, I think it was a few months before she was, maybe 6 months before she died, she was, she became the ambassador to France, an incredible mind and one of the most just genuinely kind people and just a ray of light really for all of us. And it was a real shock when she passed. And I think not being able to process the grief, not being able to mourn, and for the first time recognizing this part of myself that wanted to care for others in a way that completely neglected myself. And that's something I've carried with me through life. Like I
So you what? You were worried about your own
parents,
family?
My parents, yeah. I remember my dad telling me, and for the first time seeing him cry. And that was like, you know, a real shock. I think the first time you realize that your parents are in some way not superheroes that you make them out to be can be really scary and can be kind of, oh my God, who's going to look after us now? Who's, you know, and not that it was over the top. It was really just him expressing like sadness as his sister had passed. And I think that that was a real shock, and not being able to fully heal that, and I think became a real problem. And as a result, you know, as many people who have suffered with eating disorders and addictions, like, they're very similar, you know, is you just want to control something. And for me, not being able to control the grief, not being able to control the massive emotion I was feeling, resulted in me very quickly just finding a little bit of a buzz in dieting and in reading magazines and being taken in by the, like, in kind of like insidious beauty standard that was just thrown at us, as you know, especially in the 90s, the early 2000s. I think it was totally different to the way it is now. We have a new problem, you know, that there's no doubt we have a new kind of body dysmorphia brewing. But I think back then it was that cigarettes and Diet Coke, breakfast, you know,
kind nothing of skinny. Tastes as good as skinny feels, all
this
of that.
Is it. I found myself being so bought, like, I bought into that so deeply as a 10-year-old.
Exactly, you just said it there, 9, 10.
Yeah, which is crazy.
You don't really question, you're going to, your mind is going to absorb your surroundings and think, oh, this is normal.
Yeah,
you exactly. say it like that. I mean, obviously there's a big age gap between us, but I remember it as a different age.
Yeah.
But I'm just imagining if I was younger, hearing all of that constantly.
Yeah.
It was, and nobody questioned it.
That's it.
It was normal. You were, it was aspirational to be that kind of waif-like figure as a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
You think of it now, it's actually bonkers.
It is insane. And you think about like the What Now magazine and the likes of even OK and the ones that were deemed to be a little bit more respectable, you know, what they were right about women, what they look like without any makeup on, women, what they look, you know, it was shame for looking anything less than perfect. And so I think very early I tuned myself into that and said, OK, in order to be able to, you know, impress in life, in order to be able to, like, I always had that kind of perfectionist streak. I tuned myself into that and I went, I'm going to look like that. I am going to be Kate Moss. I am going to look, and like, you're a child, you know, when I'm so sensitive when I meet a 9 or 10 or 11 year old and I go, Jesus, all you're doing is having the crack. All you're doing is talking about play dates. You might not be invited to something, or like, these are the things that I should have been worried about. But instead I memorized the packets of everything. I knew the calories and absolutely everything. You could quiz me on any type of food. I just go into supermarkets and I remember what the fat content was, what the carbohydrate content was, the sugars, and the how many calories is in something. And it was just, that became an obsession. And very quickly, I think over that summer, before I turned 10, like over that summer, my parents kind of were becoming a little bit more aware of it. Yeah. We actually got a dog once Kate passed. We got a dog, Sevi, and I remember running the poor puppy, like the legs off it. Like, we were like doing laps of it in the house in Lahinch. Just the poor dog was like, no more. And I was like, come on, one more. You know, it was madness. Like, it's that relentless part of your brain then that becomes addicted to starving. It becomes addicted to dieting, controlling what you eat, feeling a sense of pride in that I couldn't equate with any other part of my life, you know. So quickly it became my identity, actually, being the healthy one, the skinny one, the one who's very sporty, the one who, you know, at first it was kind of complimented by neighbours, by family members. It was like, oh, Mary Kate's very good. She doesn't take anything she doesn't take any treats anymore. Isn't that great? Like, fair play to her. And then it kind of slid down into a problem by the time I went back to school.
And was it noticed? Because at that age, I suppose, maybe perhaps naively, I would have think that, Asher, look, at 9, 10, you're too young to be even thinking, you know, that somebody might have an eating disorder. Sure, that wouldn't happen until maybe teenage years, if it's going to present itself. Do you know, that's probably a very ignorant thing for me to admit. But
I don't think so at all.
Is it not?
Not at all. I would say it was almost like people were actually in disbelief.
Right.
You know, that I could be so... I think, like, my parents were very, like, we were a very close family. We are a very close family.
Yeah,
so it was, in ways, it was easy for them to see because they controlled mealtimes. You know, they made the breakfast, they made the lunch, they made the dinner. They could see exactly what I was going, no, I don't want that, and I want chickpeas. And like, that's, you know, 2006, people didn't even know what chickpeas were. It was like, what are you talking about? You know, yeah, like, yeah. I was like, I want chickpeas and avocado, and I want, you know. And it, at first that was fine. That was at the more innocent stages. And then it became, all I'm eating is wafer thin ham. All I'm eating is like random things, like all I'm drinking is Diet Coke, I'm no longer drinking water, all I'm eating is 6 strawberries a day. Like, it got to that in the kind of the darker times.
Okay.
But it was quickly noticed, and then I think my parents, you know, having spoken to them over the years, I think like the way they would process it, you know, at that time, you know, I hadn't even got the diagnosis yet. It was like, we'll get Mary-Kate back into school. Maybe the routine will help her. She'll be back with her friends, you know, back from the Hinge. We're back in Dublin now, and, you know, we can resume normal life. And that's really important, to try and keep things as normal as possible when somebody's going through this, you know. And I think they did the right thing by sending me back to school, but it was when the teachers were kind of following me into the bathrooms and saw me dumping my lunches, and, you know, I was trading things with people in class. Like, I think I was too far along now at this stage to actually feel like I could solve it myself.
Yeah.
And so it was an adult psychiatrist in the Mater Hospital had, after hours, met me, and because there was nobody there body wise, my mum was reaching out, and they wouldn't look at anyone under 17. You know,
has that changed?
It has changed, yeah, thankfully. Okay. And I know that, you know, John of God's has a unit, and Passing Pass is a unit now, but at that time it was nothing. Like, you know, for somebody who was that age, it wouldn't be right to have sent me into John of God's where it's 18 and over, or St. Pat's, or, you know, Dundrum or wherever.
Am I right in thinking you're in your mid-20s now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm 25.
Yeah, so we're going back 15 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And thankfully things have changed now. I know they still have a way to go, but the landscape is very different now to how it was for you, right? Yeah. So how did you end up in the Mater?
Through one of my dad's friends. Like, okay. It was that kind of desperation. It was like, anyone who can help us.
So
like,
they knew... Our girl is not, she's not doing good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They had an idea that it was anorexia. It was a GP that we went to who just said, look, I deal with coughs and colds, but my sneaking suspicion is this is what it could be.
Okay.
And so that's when we were going to, well, they were going, like, I always tell the story, and I feel like I was actually really lucky in a way, like, because I didn't experience it from my parents' lens. Like, I can't imagine now that I'm getting older and I'm becoming more aware of, you know, like, maybe I want to be a mum someday. And I think about how painful it must have been for them to just watch your child disappear. You know, for me, I was on a tunnel vision, and I was kind of like almost getting, I was energized by the journey in a way. Like, obviously it was completely pulling me apart and destroying me. But there was an energy that came from it that was, I have a mission.
And there was a buzz.
There was a buzz. So yeah. I was tunnel vision, protected by all of the chaos it was causing my family, the girls. You know, when we would go to doctor appointments, they'd just be lumped in on neighbours and aunts and uncles. And I was oblivious to all of that. So yeah. When I think about now, about the journey now, I have a huge respect and like a profound gratitude to my parents for just sticking with me. Because there were so many times where I was just hell to be around. Like, my mum called me the changeling, you know, in like Irish mythology or in Celtic mythology, you know, the baby that goes into the forest and is taken by the fairies. You know, that's what it was like. You know, just
right.
They lost me. You know, I remember even one day, this is probably, I'd say maybe a year on from the diagnosis, coming down the stairs from school, and like in this, you know, the parents would all be standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I kind of walked down and I was like, mum, like waving at her, and she was looking over me. She didn't recognize me. You know, I was so gaunt and just really just lost. Like, I wasn't there. So like, I remember that, my mum kind of looking over me and not recognizing me, and the other parents, you know, just horrible, horrible stuff. Sorry, I'm getting a bit sad thinking about it. But sure, listen, the way I think about it now is it's important to tell the story because I got the help that I needed. Yeah. And so many people don't.
Mm.
So many people live with it, you know, or can recover like 75% and still have that controlling part of their mind, you know. And like, I just feel so passionately about people can recover fully and take their lives back and just become themselves again, you know. It's not easy, Jesus Christ, it's hell. Like, it is hell. The road to recovery is so hard, and there'll always be that part of you, like, you know, the people who are susceptible to eating disorders and equally addiction are often people who have put immense pressure on themselves, and are, you know, hold themselves to a very high standard. There's a certain type of personality that kind of has the prerequisite to getting, you know, an eating disorder, or, you know, and that part of your brain doesn't change. Like, I have it now with boxing. I have it now with my academics, that part of me that's be the best. And if you, like, for example, the Leaving Cert, if I got less than 600 points, I failed it. You know,
right.
All of this, it manifests in other ways.
Yeah.
And it's about becoming aware of that and actually becoming friends with that, which I can go into to later. And that's how I found in my boxing journey is, you know, actually becoming friends with that part of your brain that wants to be the best.
Yeah.
But it's all about where you direct that energy and that focus.
Yes.
You know? So that's why I share it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we've just been talking for a very short time, but it's so moving listening to you speak. And as you said, you know, I'm getting a bit sad. It is very sad, but also it's really powerful that you're here as somebody who has completely reshaped their life and is absolutely thriving. And that's why I was excited to talk to you today, because I think you're a phenomenal person. And at 25, what you've already achieved, I'm just going, I'll be one of these people that in 10 years time will say, I spoke to Mary Kate Lattery. She sat in front of me.
Yes,
when no, I mean it, because I think, you know, the future is very exciting for you. And I mean that wholeheartedly.
Thank you.
And when you said that, I suppose maybe, and I don't think necessarily you have to be a parent to appreciate, as you said, you don't have kids yet, but, you know, you can try and put yourself in your parents' shoes and imagine what that must feel like when your daughter comes out and you don't recognize her. Like, I felt that so deeply when you said that. And that's why I think it's important to have these conversations, because no doubt there'll be people listening to this that perhaps might be concerned about someone in their life. And maybe this is what they need to hear to tune in and ask questions and maybe see what's going on. And maybe it's not an eating disorder, maybe something else. But I suppose it's important to ask why, or why is the person behaving this way, or what's going on, to try and help. Because I suppose, what is life about? Like, we're here. We're not just here for ourselves. We're here to ideally enrich someone else's life or other people's lives and help. And I suppose it sounds like, you know, you wouldn't be here today without your parents' love and care for you.
Absolutely.
To try and get you the help that you needed.
Definitely. And I think also, maybe if somebody's listening to this and they don't recognize, you know, that if they're not able to relate for another person, but for themselves, you know, because a lot of people, when I speak to schools now, and a lot of people, when I speak about that enormous pressure, that weight that people carry around to be the best and to constantly improve and to, you know, to focus on something, and it takes you down an unhealthy path, you know, to have this enormous pressure, whether it's the beauty standard, whether it's your schoolwork, your job, you know, your family, your relationship that you're trying so hard to make work, and all of these things. I think that, you know, just being able to be okay with imperfections and be okay with, you know, not this unrealistic standard that's just marketed to us in every facet of life.
Yeah.
You know, we're told that if we have X, we'll be better. If we have this, we'll
be
better.
Happy when.
In 6 weeks' time, if you just subscribe to this, you know, there's all of these heal-alls and secrets and fixing. Like, life is about getting comfortable with the shit.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? And getting comfortable, and the only certainty is that there will be uncertainty. That's the only thing you can count on, is that we haven't a clue what we're doing here. So, like, let's just, you know, try and get comfortable with ourselves on the journey.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's no place that we're ever going to be fully satisfied. Like, that's not what life's about. You know, there's always going to be something there for us to be working on, and just let it go. And just, you know, I always say, like, we're all just, I feel like this sometimes, you know, you said you love the sea, like being from Connemara. And I feel like sometimes when I look at the stars, I'm just reminded, and this is my mantra through life, is that we're all just grains of shite. And like, that might sound really gross and really like horrible, but that gives me so much calm and so much like just support actually.
Yeah,
in
what
those
am I
moments.
Worrying about?
Exactly. I'm worried about what does this person think of me and what does that person and what does that say about me if I do this? No, hang on. Look at the stars. Look how small we are.
Yeah.
We're here for a flash of a second, you know, in the grand scheme of what life's about. So like, honestly, if you're not laughing and you're not having the crack, what's the point?
What's
you know,
the point?
What is the point? So that's, I think, is we're all just grains of shite is the thing that like whenever I feel like I'm caring too
I
much
love
about
it. Inspirational
something.
Quotes brought to you by Mary.
Yeah, we are all just grains of shite. Yeah, you can buy my t-shirt.
So, when you were talking about, you know, 9 turning 10 and you're the eldest of 3 girls, what's the age gap between you and your sisters?
Lucy is a year younger than me and Isolde is 5 years younger.
Okay.
So
yeah. Like, you're obviously your parents are not just caring for you, they're caring for your 2 younger sisters as well and mindful of the impact your experience was having on them. And clearly, you know, you have been too now that you're out the other side and you can kind of reflect on it and look back. When you ended up in the matter, when were you told the words like that?
Yeah.
Were you told or were your parents told?
We were told together, myself, my mum and my dad. And this consultant obviously just said, you know, you have anorexia. And for me, I was like, over my head. I don't know what that is. Like, I had no idea what those words represented. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
My parents obviously knew, but not a whole lot. Again, like, it's a different really time. Like, now we speak about it and it is destigmatized in a way, but it has its own connotations, I think, anorexia. And I had it explained to me at that age, you know, as somebody in a voice in my head telling me not to eat. And that I was going to have to beat this voice. I didn't understand anything beyond that, you know.
That's kind of huge to take on board at 10.
It is. And I think it's important to say that too, because a lot of people and the kind of the connotations around anorexia and some of the stigma is that it is something you bring on yourself or something that, oh, she's gone anorexic now or she's, you know, she's like, I know that in when I was being treated, there was a huge amount of like pro Anna websites and stuff like that. Thankfully, I was too young to know any of that. I, you know, didn't have access to any of that stuff. But the argument against somebody who might say, oh, anorexia is brought on when somebody wants to be anorexic is I didn't know what it was. I had it explained to me as a little voice in my head that I'm going to have to beat. I'm going to have to recognize and beat. And ultimately, it is that. But yeah, coming back to my sisters and the guilt, I'd be lying if I said I didn't carry some guilt from that, you know. Less so now. I think over the last like 2 years, I've been doing therapy called compassion focused therapy, which is basically about what we're talking about, you know, when we're second guessing everything and we're really just critical of ourselves. It's about kind of externalizing the critic and personifying the critic so that you recognize it as a part of you that doesn't serve you. And we can go into that. There's so much to talk about.
How do you do that?
So to be honest, it comes off the, like, I did years of CBT, like cognitive behavioral therapy,
yes,
in order to get to really, what I'm saying, you know, battle that voice and beat that voice. And that part of your brain that is your anorexia, it's so hard to explain to somebody who hasn't been through it, is that it is... such a, if you're married to that part of your brain, because it brings you so much comfort and safety. Like, my anorexia kept me safe. It gave me a sense of control. It gave me a sense of power. It gave me a purpose. It gave me the energy. Like, I loved my anorexia for so long. And I think that a lot of people who are in recovery will admit that that's the hardest part of recovery, is letting go of that part of you that your mind has twisted you into believing it has helped you, you know, or it is your friend. And I'm obviously don't have experience of addiction, but that often is kind of, there's a correlation there,
yes,
between,
yeah,
you know, that's a safety and that's something that keeps you, it gives you that sense of accomplishment that you need, you know, the dopamine hit or whatever it might
be.
You know, so I found that was the hardest part, But the CBT was the part that goes, all right, let's really analyze the thoughts. Let's look at the negative automatic thoughts that come up around mealtimes. Let's talk about what is it that's being presented to you? Where is the fear coming from? And understanding that your feelings and your thoughts and your actions are all linked. And when you start having a thought, it'll have a knock-on effect to the feeling. When you have a feeling, it'll have a knock-on effect to your action. So how it's all linked, and it's about catching those thoughts. And I remember, like, the exercise as a kid was like imagining I was on like an island, and it was all very visual because I that's just the way I learned, but pretending I was catching gnats, like little flies, the negative automatic thoughts. So I'd like catch them in a net and I'd pull them out, and I, with my incredible psychiatrist Fiona, who I was with when I was in Crumlin for the three stints that I had in Crumlin, three long stints, she did so much, but the resources weren't there, and that's why I went to London. But she would have me open up pretend I was opening it up and just say, what is the automatic thought? And it would be, if I eat this, I won't fit into my clothes. If I eat this, I will be huge. If I eat this, I won't know what to do. I will, like, you know, just really extreme things, believing that, like, even having a shower, I was afraid that the salt would get into my body and would make me gain weight. Like, I think it just total irrational fears, but weighing it up and going, here's why that's not true.
Yeah.
And then 99% of the time, you see that those thoughts they're invalid. They're not real. They're irrational. You can let them go. And it took years of working at that to be able to catch the fears and catch the blocks that were making me sick, you know?
Yes. And this is why CBT is so powerful, and it works for so many people. And for you, you have, you know... You were in a situation where treatment was necessary for your own healing, and you're just, it's important to say, and I know you've already probably said it, but like you have recovered.
Yeah.
You fully believe that your eating disorder is in the past.
Yes.
You
definitely.
Know. But I think we can all benefit from whatever the therapy is, whether it is, you know, going to a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist or CBT or whatever therapy. I think we can all benefit from learning more about ourselves and what triggers us or what. And I suppose now you are a well-oiled machine, and that's why there's so much more to talk to you about, because you are probably one of the most aware humans on the planet.
Days where that's not true at all. I don't know.
But I was like, I'm going to meet Mary Kate. Like, she's probably, you know, fully present at every moment of every day and knows what her why is at all times. You know, I just...
Definitely not.
But, but you know, you did touch on it there, and you said you did three stints in Crumlin and then you had to go to London. So like that day that you were told with your folks you had anorexia, it wasn't a case of, you've anorexia, run a sort and you'll be grand. Unfortunately... Mm. It was a number of years before you were in a position where you were in, you know, the beginning of your recovery.
Yeah, definitely.
And unfortunately got a lot worse before that happened.
It did.
Going to the UK was a big step for your family, I would imagine. Why was that necessary?
It was a huge step. And it was necessary because we had three failed attempts in Crumlin. And the first time I went into Crumlin, so after I got the diagnosis, it was kind of something that we decided there'd be goals and there'd be steps to try and treat it at home. And it just got too bad that after a number of threats, we're going to take you into Crumlin tonight if you don't do this, if you were going to do that. It became so horrible for the whole home environment became so, it just became so brittle and just, we were all worn out from it, you know, even my sisters, you know, I actually think they're probably more aware than I am because they watched the whole thing happen and they just had they have such a maturity about them from it. I think we all do. Like we did some important work together, but...
Well, obviously, do you know what? It's funny you say the word and you use the word mature, because anytime I've heard you speak, even though you certainly look your age, you're very young and vibrant, but there's a maturity about you and a wisdom about you that, you know, if I didn't see you when I heard you, I said, that's a woman in her 40s.
Jesus, thank you.
No, because there is, because you've done far more work on yourself than the majority of us do in a lifetime. Because unfortunately what you went through, and because I suppose you have now a huge interest in learning more about yourself, you've done so many cool things. But with that comes huge insight and wisdom. So it's interesting that you say that about that is that's that there's been something that's been shared by your whole family.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very nice to hear. I think we have, and we're able to laugh about it now, which is a real sign of healing, I think, when you're able to come out the other side.
Yeah. The point of laughter about something pretty grim is I would imagine that takes a lot of growth and work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. But I think, you know, the reason we went to London is because ultimately they didn't have the resources in Crumlin. And like, they really tried their best, and like, God bless them. I was put on a burns ward, I was put on a cardiac ward, like an orthopedic ward. Do you know, they did not have, mental health wasn't a thing. I was just the skinny kid in the room next to the nurse's station that you can't close her window. Like, there was a big glass window and I was monitored 24/7. Do you know, you can't close that window. You have to watch her and make sure that she's not running, make sure that she's not doing this. I had a heart monitor on to make sure that I wasn't exercising. You know, they really tried their best. But when I met Fiona once a week at the back of the car park in a porter cabin,
okay,
like, that's what we're dealing with.
Right.
You know, there just wasn't the resource. There wasn't. And she was always stretched and always stressed, and such an incredible woman, and has done such incredible things, and helped change the landscape for mental health services and particularly eating disorders. She's just a legend. Like, I couldn't speak any more highly of her. And she was intrinsic in trying to get me help in the UK, which was ultimately at that point, I wasn't recovering. Crumlin would get me to a healthy-ish BMI where my organs were no longer in threat mode. It was like, okay, the 9th percentile, and I'd fixate on that number from the first day of admission, and I go, grand, I'll get to that. I'll play the game. I'll make them not make it look like I'm good. And then the second I'd leave, of course, anorexia would go crazy again, and I'd just be back on my downward spiral.
Because once you were back in your home environment,
it's easier to hide things. It's easier to do everything. And, you know, my parents did such an incredible job, but it's just at that point, there's no coming back from it. You know, the fight was too massive,
okay,
for all of us.
How bad did it get?
It got really bad. Like, I remember, it's funny, like, even in my mind, like, remembering those things in kind of like a monochrome color, like, everything was just gray and bleak, and I just didn't want to be there, and I wanted it all to end. I remember one day a nurse coming into from the nurse's station. She was like the head nurse on the ward, kind of coming in and trying to scare me. I think at that point there was frustration too, because there wasn't awareness around anorexia. I was, you know, some nurses would be like, oh, come on, like, you're wasting the bed, kind of thing. Like, that was there was an assumption that I could actually make myself better if I wanted to. And
God,
the nurse came in, and this is the only time I ever saw Fiona, my psychiatrist, ever go up or down, you know, like, in an emotional way.
Okay.
The nurse basically said to me, look, your heart rate dropped so low last night, we didn't know whether you'd make it through, kind of thing.
Whoa.
And like, I was 10, do you know, and
yeah,
just
exactly,
trying to hear that, you're just, but for me, I was in my state. It was scary, but I was like, cool.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I was in that place where I was just like, score. Like, anytime anyone like would be moved or in any way scared or threatened by how thin I was, that was a win. Like, and trying to understand that now, I'm like, that makes no sense, do you know? But it was in that place. It was like, you know, as I went on, I remember being in Lahinch and my friends in school crying in the national school when they hugged me. And I went away for a few months and I came back and it was really bad. And they were crying and I was just like, this is so fulfilling. Like, it was the weirdest, most twisted way of thinking. I wasn't myself at all. You know, I was angry, I was irritated, I was, you know, quite aggressive, and I'm a very peaceful person, and quite like, even in confrontation, I'd always be quite diplomatic. And like, you know, it was just like, I was just me and my anorexia and our goal, and nothing else mattered.
You were 25. If you could go back and sit beside your 10-year-old self, what would you do?
Oh, I'd just give her a hug, because it's just so tiring. The whole thing is just so exhausting.
Yeah.
Just like, everything will be okay, do you know? Because it's a really lonely disease. Mm. Like, and that's the one thing that I went to London recently and I interviewed my psychiatrist from Great Ormond Street, where I ended up going for a year. And then I was a year outpatient, but I went to interview Professor John Golden for another thing that I'm doing. And just talking to him, like, I was struck, even the smell and the colour of the paint of the walls and just the way he was speaking, I just was brought back to such a lonely place. Because that's the one thing about it, is you and your mission, and you're married to that part of your brain that is killing you, literally killing you.
Yeah.
But you can't let it go, you know? And that's the main feeling I'm left with when I, you know, when I see somebody, I'm just somebody who's going through it, I just feel such sadness for the loneliness. You know, there's a whole host of problems and how, like, you know, but that overwhelming loneliness and isolation and feeling nobody understands me. And an actual, like, when I first was admitted into London, into the Mildred Creek unit, I remember not speaking, going on complete silent strike, you know, and like, you have to respect the determination of that child. Like,
yeah,
there was nobody who was getting through to me, you know, and it was after kind of a clinical assessment because, you know, obviously it was the NHS who were taking me on. The HSE funded it. Yeah. It was just incredible. But it was, a lot of it was my parents advocating for me and Fiona advocating and just kind of going, this is so serious, we need you to take it on. And
yeah.
I met a host of doctors that morning before I was admitted, and you know, they said, you want the good news or the bad news? And the good news is she's absolutely eligible. The bad news is one of the most severe cases we've seen. You know, it was that level of just, okay, no problem. Because my parents went with the intention, we're not leaving until she's in that bed and
yeah,
we can relax.
She's getting help,
you know. Because before I left, before we went to London, the doctors had said, like, even the flight would be so intense on my body, you know. And I actually...
That's how fragile you
were.
That's
how fragile. Like, I was so sick, you know, and just the most unhappy, broken child, you know. It's so sad now when I think about it. But I'm also wouldn't change any of it because it has given me like a strength and a confidence that when the going gets tough now in life, I go, it'll be okay, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it is, it's incredibly sad. And now, you know, oh yeah, so the loneliness I was talking about and how anyone who was kind to me, and they were so incredibly kind in London. Like, while it was a very strict regime, it was very much, if you don't cooperate, if you don't do exactly as the program says, you won't see your family, you won't do this. Like, it was very strict.
Oh, wow.
Very strict.
Okay.
And
what? So you...
It was kind
so,
of...
So they would say that?
Yeah.
You won't see your family?
Yeah. And that was kind of the thing with anorexia is, like, you give it an inch, it takes a mile. It's very deceptive. And it's one of those things you cannot budge with
all
anorexia.
Right, okay.
Like,
so it was the definition of tough love, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. It was that. And obviously, I say this, you know, with the caveat, every experience of anorexia is very personal, very
yeah, okay,
individual. So I'm only an expert in my experience and not in everyone else's.
And it is, it's you know, I'm glad you said that because I have recorded another conversation about disordered eating before, and I discovered through the recording of it and the release of it that it's a very complicated topic to cover, and one that I would be a little nervous of because there's so many different perspectives. And I think sometimes naively, I, as somebody who I'm certainly familiar with disordered eating, actually, the more I discover and talk to people, the more I realize that, you know, while I thought everything was, you know, air quotes, normal in my own attitude to food, I have my own stuff. And I think a lot of us do.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like a line, and where are you on the line? Are you at the extreme level or the lower end or whatever? But I suppose the reason I'm saying that is I realized afterwards, wow, you could put your foot in it without realizing and say something that could potentially cause a lot of harm to the person listening. So I suppose you're extremely conscious of that because you've gone through it yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And I know from, you know, it you're so right. It is something that you can say the wrong thing. And, you know, even for me, like in my own experience of it, saying the wrong thing was detrimental. Do you know, it
okay,
was like people were afraid to say anything and open their mouths, like, because they might say the wrong thing and it would trigger me into thinking all sorts of, you know, even the connotations I had with, you know, like my relationship with the word "you look healthy" was just, you may as well have called me an elephant, you know, because if saying
really,
even I remember coming home for a weekend, or maybe it was an afternoon, like it was kind of that kind of way, I'd come home from hospital and my neighbour, like me going up to collect the girls for dinner, and just, you know, her at the door saying, "Oh, Mary Kate, it's great to see you back. You know, the colour's coming back in your cheeks. You look amazing. You look so healthy." And I just screamed and ran home. And I was just like, "Oh my God, I've completely lost control. I'm spiraling. I'm huge again. I look like, you know," because I was so attached to being thin and being gaunt. And okay. like that was, you know, that was my, I was just attached to that.
Yeah, so you had such a warped association with the word healthy.
Yeah, really did. And so that's why it's so important yes. when talking about this. I am only an expert in my experience.
Yeah.
And I know as well from like over the years, meeting families and meeting parents and talking to them, you know, individually, everybody's looking for an answer and everybody's looking for, you know, you're so desperate in that state. Like there is nothing worse than living with somebody who has that. There is like, it's so tricky. It's so hard to understand and where they're at. And all I can say is there's no quick fix. Like there's no set of rules that will help somebody with anorexia. Everybody will say that, you know, yeah. all of the professionals who deal with it, it's totally individual. And it's about, you know, understanding what's underneath it all, because ultimately the dieting and the control and the lack of the starving yourself, that's a symptom. Like the food is such a small part of anorexia, actually. Like it's the biggest, but it's also like there's so many other parts, not the small parts, but the there's a part of it is,
yeah, I get
is
you.
Eating, and there's so much others that goes with it, and why did it manifest, and what part of your brain is telling you to do what, and it's so complex.
And as you said, it's mental illness. I mean, people yeah. I suppose sometimes think it's a physical illness, but it's not. It's a mental illness that manifests physically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is, when you look at how it impacts people and the devastating impact of it, it is frightening. And it does sound like, despite in the 15 years we've come on a lot, it does sound like we need to do a lot more work here.
Huge yeah. amount. And I think even after the lockdown, I know that there are so many more that seem to be affected, just from my kind of gauge of the whole thing and
yeah.
my friends, you know, and everybody feeling like, when we were all like, what is going on? And the future's uncertain and nothing seems rooted in anything. We're all just, you know, next week could be taken away from us with another lockdown and all of this kind of fear. A lot of us turned to our food and yeah. the trips to the supermarket and, you know, what we were eating and dieting and that sort of like, and a
or
lot
the
of
other
us
extreme,
gained,
which was, yeah, the comfort eating.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And now,
which I certainly did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I definitely found comfort in food during the pandemic.
Of
and
course.
Ara, look, we're at home. I'm sure I'm not going anywhere anyway. Can yeah. I have that extra bit of cake? And that's fine. And, you know, that's
Absolutely.
Grand if that makes you feel good. But then it's why are you doing it, or how is it really making you feel?
Yeah.
And you're right. I suppose disordered eating practices probably were on the rise. Certainly sounds like they were.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So at 12 years of age, you spent how long in Greater Ormond Street?
I spent 10 months as an inpatient and then 12 months as an outpatient, which meant, you know, flying. It was quite a staggered discharge. And they came back with me, my two, we had key workers. So like, just the in comparison, when I compare poor Crumlin trying its best, having some really well-intentioned doctors and nurses and dietitians and who just didn't know how to deal with it, and Fiona, who obviously was top of the game in the country and still is, you know, her trying to fight just this uphill battle that just says we can't get the time, we can't have the resource. And I compare that to the first day sitting in front of the nurses and doctors in Great Ormond Street, who, you know, four of them met me before they made the decision to take me on. And then it was, I you know, it's a pediatric hospital. You're treated as, you have a pediatrician, and then you have your psychiatrist who's assigned to you. You have psychologists, you have the mental health nurses, you have key workers. Like it was a whole team to just get me back on my feet. And how it's a specialized unit, you know, they only had 7 beds. That's it, you know. And yeah. for me to have been able to get a bed there was enormous, like huge.
Yeah.
With the
and
others.
And unfortunately, it was a reflection of the severity of your illness at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, definitely.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
When did it start to click with you that only I can get myself better?
I think it was, I try to identify like a light bulb moment, and I don't think there was one. I think there was a series of things are starting to feel lighter. And I think, you know, then going in and getting the help was just, it took a long time for me to adopt, you know, kind of get with the program. But what was amazing was like the peer support there with others who were going through such incredible journeys of their own. You know, I was the only one in the first few months with anorexia, and there was other people with completely different disorders, and seeing their journey and the support actually between the others who were going through such massive challenges was huge. And it was, you know, obviously there was kind of the good cops and the bad cops, and there was some like really kind of hardline people who were just not budging. And ultimately, if you don't, you know, get with the program, you're left behind, you know.
That must have been scary.
It was, but it was exactly what I needed.
Okay.
It was exactly what I needed, because I was so determined that I needed to meet kind of fire with fire. I felt, again, some people, that's not the line of recovery, but for me it was. And
yeah, for your personality type.
Yeah. And I remember even a trip to the cinema that I had with my parents. It was like a big deal. Things were going better, and you know, I gained a little bit of weight. I was feeling a little bit healthier. My brain chemistry started to actually enjoy things, and you know, it was a very, like, it wasn't a normal, it wasn't a normal unit. You know, there was no nurses and doctors outfits, like, or the, not the outfits, what did you call it, uniforms. There were no uniforms. We had our own bedding, we had our own beds. There were no hospital beds. It was like a big apartment. And it was just to keep things as normal as possible. And on a Thursday night, we'd be allowed to go out, and we'd go to the, like, there was Coram's Fields behind Great Ormond Street, for anyone who knows it, is like a little petting zoo, and there was like little sheep and little things, and just finding a little bit of joy, which felt so wrong actually at first. I was like, I can't enjoy myself, you know. That it was just like learning to actually take a little bit of pleasure in life and be able to just be a kid. That helped me, it inspired me to get my life back, really, is like those little memories of, you know, even I became obsessed with the movie Napoleon Dynamite. I don't know if you've ever seen
class.
It's class.
Best dance scene in the movie ever.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I know the whole dance. I have the Vote for Pedro top. I have the moon boots. I was obsessed. I used to, for, like, when I went back to school, I used to wear the Vote for Pedro top under my uniform every day. Like, I was obsessed with it.
And do you eat tater tots?
Oh, of course. Tina, you fat lard. Like, I was obsessed. It was so
good.
Funny.
So good.
So I am...
And I suppose, because you were, like, for years, you were punishing yourself constantly. So enjoying something, feeling pleasure, was that just a bit mad?
Yeah.
But in a good way.
Yeah.
Well, I know you were saying you were deriving, I suppose, a certain type of warped pleasure from the, you know, what you were putting yourself through, I suppose.
Yeah.
But enjoying something in the real sense of the word, I suppose, what does real mean? But, you know, in the pure sense of the word, you were having a pleasurable experience that wasn't your mind playing tricks on you. Was that different?
It was. And I think that, like, I had a newfound appreciation for things, to be honest. And I remember like the joy I felt. Even like the day I was, you know, we had this like leaving drinks was like a thing when people were, it was a party basically with all of the medical staff who were looking after you and your parents and all of the other patients on the unit. And it was kind of, it was almost to inspire others to reach that stage. It was, they really did ceremony really well. And like, they had this handprint tree where you could paint your hand and put your hand on. And I went back and visited it a few months ago. And just
how,
like,
was that?
It was amazing. It was like so emotionally draining, and it was like up and down, up and down. And I remember meeting, there was this one woman in particular. She was like a care worker there, Sheen, just this incredible mammy, like, who, even when the going got really tough, when I turned on everyone else, Sheen was there for a big cuddle and a kiss, and just sometimes that's all you needed.
Yeah.
She is just such an incredible person. I can't even begin to describe. But yeah, seeing her again and being brought back to that place, because I think I'd done a good job at, you know, compartmentalizing it and having spoken about it so much over the years now.
But actually experiencing it again.
Yeah.
I could feel it from you. I could see it from you, the emotion. Yeah.
Yeah. Just being brought back to that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And I spoke to the patients that are there now.
Yeah.
I spoke to the girls that were there.
Oh, wow.
Four of them. And I was brought right back to just, first of all, how like incredibly articulate and intelligent they are. And they're all, you know, 12, 13, 14, but they're just so, like, they're doing so much work at articulating their feelings and trying to tell you exactly how they feel, that when you ask them, it was just like the most incredible conversation.
Yeah.
I spoke a little bit about my journey. I asked them about theirs and how open they were. And also at one stage, this is the part that just resonated with me so deeply, is that, you know, one of them started to quite like to panic halfway through. I think it was getting close to mealtime or something was triggering her.
Okay.
And like the emotion, like, was just screaming, crying and letting it out. And the others didn't even flinch. You know, you just became so used to people fully expressing themselves.
Okay,
you know,
I
think it's so funny in this like wellness world we live in now, we're all like, express yourself and let it go and whatever. But like, that is the highest form of just like somebody screaming, kicking, crying, and the conversation just continues. Like, the ball is still kicked around between the three of us who are.
Yeah, nobody's trying to fix it.
Nobody.
They're letting that person be.
Exactly.
And that's just holding space for people. That's powerful, isn't it?
That's what it is. And I feel like so much of today's problems, and maybe this is wrong to say, but I feel like so much of today's problems comes from us repressing and trying to be okay all the time.
I absolutely agree with you, yeah.
Yeah, I just think,
totally,
if we can just go, today's shite, and just let it all out and just let, and then it's gone. And it's not about the day being ruined or the week being ruined or any of that. It's the moment, and let it go. You know, the moment is really tricky. How are we going to navigate it? Cool, let it out, jump, scream, kick around, you know. And that's what I'm trying to do now with this movement meditation and the mindful boxing, is just like, oh my God, you're feeling angry? Cool, brilliant, channel that. Let's go, let it go, you know. And just, you know, finding your peace then afterwards. And that was amazing to watch and to kind of validate that feeling that I had and that everybody has, I think, you know, is that we're repressing and we're holding on to so much. Let it out, and don't judge anyone else for, you know, letting their feelings hang out, because that's the problem, is that we don't, you know.
And with you completely.
Yeah.
When you were getting all the help and you're now in a state of recovery, was delving into your aunt who passed away, was that the key to your recovery?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't think it was. I think
that was just what brought it about.
Yeah, yeah. And I think even to this day, I say about my aunt and the grief and all of that, it's almost like an easy way to introduce it. But if I'm like, to be honest, I think it was in a multitude of things. Like,
okay.
I was just, I do believe I was born with an overdeveloped sense of drive and focus. And
as you said, perfection.
Exactly. And that doesn't change. Even when I, you know, come to terms with grief and when I come to terms with, you know, loss and all the rest of it, I think that that's just in me. And
did you feel pressure? And this might sound like a strange question to ask, but clearly anyone who's come across you, and I know it's something that you have to kind of, you're probably eye roll, I have to deal with this all the time because I'm a boxer, and then certain people will comment on how I look. So how you look is that you are blessed with very good looks. You're very good looking.
Thank you.
And I suppose, look, that's just fact. And, you know, also beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We all know that. But I suppose aesthetically, if you were to kind of analyse what makes a person, you know, aesthetically beautiful, you're kind of ticking all boxes. Was that an extra pressure? Because you're blessed with good looks anyway. Did that make you feel like, well, then I have to continue along this line? Was that a part of it? Did that play a part?
I'm not so sure that was important, or that was something I had an awareness of when I was a kid, to be honest.
I suppose I'm trying to wonder, like, was it commented on? Because I find that, and I know now that a lot of people in the advice is, you know, when you meet someone, particularly young girls, rather than comment on, oh, you're gorgeous and you look lovely in the dress,
yeah,
compliment their talents.
Yeah.
You know, you're really good at camogie, or you're really good, God, your art is fantastic.
Yes.
You know, find what they're actually good at, compliment that rather than what they look like, what their physical appearance is.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I suppose I'm just wondering, growing up, because I would imagine if you're a very attractive 25-year-old, you were clearly a very attractive child. Was that commented on? And on some level, was that feeding into it?
I think so, definitely. And you know, when I remember cutting out pictures of Kate Moss and cutting out pictures of, like, I was more, a little bit more obsessed with the bones and the real gaunt look.
Okay.
Rather than, but I guess in my own way, I that was how I perceived beauty, you know.
Yeah.
And it's also how we were marketed beauty at that
absolutely,
time.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The Elle Macphersons and the Kate Moss, who all look incredible, but they're,
yeah,
it was just an unhealthy
the age of
depiction.
The supermodel, yeah.
Yeah. I was very aware of beauty standards, and I was very aware of that. It didn't become important. I kind of lost importance when I was really in the anorexia. Nothing else mattered other than the thinness and the, you know, my hair was literally falling out. I had hair developed all over my body, downy hair to keep me warm. Like, in terms of beauty, like, that went out the window. Like, I had literally, my hair was falling out. It hurt to smile. My skin would, like, I had to stretch my skin over my teeth to smile. Like, when I look at myself, I'm just a little skeleton, you know? So beauty standards, yeah, wasn't the issue at that point. But I think as I get older, that's something I battle with every day, you, yeah, know? And yeah, I think we all do. I think we all do, honestly.
Mm.
Especially the age of Instagram and, you know, filters and, you know, unrealistic body types, and everything is kind of, there's a certain type of look, and it might be becoming more diverse, but it is still unattainable for most people, you know.
Yeah,
whatever's represented. So,
and that's why you're so refreshing to follow on social media, because you often put up once again, air quotes, unflattering,
yeah, yeah, true,
poses of yours, that I just go, love this, love what she's about. It's, yeah, brilliant, because you're just going, you're kind of putting your two fingers up to the whole bloody lot of it.
I'm
very passionate about filters myself, and you know, I certainly don't judge anyone for using them, because I was that soldier,
yeah,
myself.
Yeah, same.
But I also had to say no more to this, because also I don't want people to meet me in reality and go, geez, you look completely different to that person online, you know. Exactly. Yeah. So you know, you've recovered and you are now a teenager, and let's fast forward to a charity event.
Oh yeah.
Do you decide? Because we haven't even started talking about I suppose what people would almost think as the main thing, Mary Kay Slattery, boxer. So now we're going to start talking about it. So you decided to give this thing a go, and again, back to the perfectionist, you weren't going to just do it half-heartedly.
That's it.
You threw yourself into it and you trained like a mad thing for a few weeks beforehand.
Yeah. And even when, it's so funny, like I met these two lads, Paddy and Sean Heaton. They have Heaton Boxing Academy up in Sandyford. They're just legends. They're such nice guys. But they were the ones who, over a pint after I went away with my school to Lourdes to do some volunteering, of all places, to like decide we're going to start boxing, was in Lourdes. Over a pint after like a day of just madness, and they were like, look, would you ever think about doing charity fight night? And I was like, I don't know, I've never thrown a punch, I don't think I'd be any use. Like,
and what age are you at this stage?
18.
Yeah,
okay, it was my first,
right,
year in Trinity. And I knew the guys from there, and they were saying to me, like, look, will you try it? And I was like, yeah, go on. Maybe it was 17. It could have been 17. No, I was 18, definitely. And they were like, let's put something on. And I was like, look, I'll do it on the condition that the charity that we do it for is for Crumlin Children's Hospital.
Cause, yeah,
you know, I still had so much respect and love for that place. And, you know, even though I didn't recover there, it was in like just I think of it so fondly, and the people there and the experience, and so I wanted to do that, and we ended up just doing this training. I was trying to get as many people on board as I could, and I think we ended up getting 30 people, so it was 15 fights, and I ended up fighting twice that night and just falling in love with the sport. Like I think for the first time when I talk about this kind of drive and this perfectionist, it was like, right, I can actually, you know, channel all of this energy that I have, extra energy, and just go, I'm going to put all of that motivation into becoming faster, becoming fitter, becoming sharper, becoming stronger. And it was like that became an obsession, you know, very quickly. And at first it was kind of, you know, just I met my now teammate Tony Brown, and he brought me down to O'Rourke's gym, or St. Michael's it was then when it was all amateur, and I met my now coach Stephen O'Rourke. And Stephen was like, you know, all right, kid, like, I'll take you on. And he's typical old school Manc. Like, he's just, everything is done. He's just so no bullshit, just exactly what you would imagine a boxer, like a real boxer, to be like, you know, kind of. Okay. He was like, look, I've never taken a girl on, but if you work hard and we give you a fight in 3 months, you know, and work hard means you're here twice a day. Like, that's the way it is. And so I was just like, grand, I'll be there. And okay. Like, that's when my, you know, that mind that had taken me down such a destructive place.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And even in school, I struggled with it, and the pressure of the Leaving Cert and all of that. I went, this is where I'm going to just be the best now. And I think like from that day, he was like, this is, I don't know what I'm after taking on, but I was there, you know, and I was obsessed.
Do you know, I can't. I'm sure this has been said to you before, but I can't help but think, like, you know, Hilary Swank.
I know.
And Clint Eastwood, it's total million dollar baby
exactly.
stuff, isn't it?
And I had never seen the movie, and they kept calling me million dollar baby. I was just like, okay, like, what the hell are they talking about? It was so weird. And then I watched it, and I was like, okay, I get it now. But it's so funny.
And the thing is, it's not just that. Okay, I'm gonna train and do this thing, but you're also then actually, she's really good.
Yeah, well,
because your first fight resulted in
Irish title.
There you go.
They just went, okay, you're going to fight someone, and you're going to just go in. And because at that point as well, like my weight class, there wasn't very many girls at it, and it's changing now. Obviously, they introduced it as an Olympic weight, and it's like there's low, it's flooded now. Like, but at that time, it was just like, okay, get in there and have the fight. And I didn't have a clue what was about to come at me. This girl from Baldoyle Boxing Club, she was brilliant. Like, she was so much more skilled. She was so much more conditioned. Like, I saw her arms and I was like, Jesus, why didn't I pick dancing or something? I was like, what am I at? But we got in the ring and I just did not stop. It was one of those, like, I look back at this because that was the Snapchat days, and like all the memories of me just head down, hands just like a combine harvester just coming at her and just like, you would need a hammer to kill me. Like, I was not stopping. And I remember like my mum being like, oh Jesus, would you just do the training? Why are you fighting? Like, why are you fighting, Jesus? And we spent so much money on your braces and all that. Like, and she was just like, why would you do it? And I was like, no, I want to do this. And like begrudgingly kind of came along to it with my dad and all my friends from school and their parents. And it was so funny. Like, and she became the loudest person in the stadium. Just like, come on, Mary Kate. Like, proper Cork woman, just bloodthirsty. She was like, go for it, go for it, you know? And I remember my coach, I could tune into my coach, like, giving me feedback. And I was kind of waiting for, like, what do I do? What, like, in between rounds, like, give me something. And he was just like, kid, just keep doing whatever you're doing. He was like, you're not boxing, you're fighting. You know, I wasn't boxing at all. It was just hands down, flurry, and did not stop. And it was that was the first time that I'd gone, wow, that part of my brain that goes, do not stop, be the best, you cannot lose here, gave me something amazing that I was so proud of. And that, like, it was that transformation in me then that I could recognize. I don't know if I recognized it in the moment, but it was afterwards that I went, Jesus, I actually applied myself and who I am and that part of my brain that just says, do it and don't stop. And it gave me something great.
And that's it, I suppose. At the end of the day, at that point, you had already had the fight of your life.
Yeah, true.
You had already overcome something that potentially was going to take your life.
Yeah.
So you had oceans of strength to draw on and to pull up and to channel when you were in the boxing ring.
True. And that's what I say to people who've been through that and a journey similar and who've come out the other
side
of addiction.
It's a classic, what doesn't kill you makes stronger.
Yeah, exactly. It's that cliche, but it's that quiet confidence that does not leave you. Like, no matter what it is, horrible breakups, the messy stuff of life.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of, in my mind, I'm like, okay, but it's never going to compare. Like, and touch wood, I never have anything that comes close to that. But, you know, the stuff that would normally trigger, I think, real hardship, I just kind of go, right, we'll just deal with this and it'll be okay, you know. Which is always something I say to somebody who's going through it. Like, if you're listening now and you're really in the pits, like, just know that when you come out the other side, which you will, when you do, that confidence won't leave you. Like, you're stronger,
so
you are bulletproof, you know, like,
and
it's great.
It is.
That's what life is as well, like being able to draw the strength from the shit. Really, you know. Anyway, I sound like I'm a prophet now. I don't want to pontificate. Like, for fact's sake, there's enough unsolicited advice out there.
No,
but
well, if it is the Church of Mary Kate Slattery, I am with you. I am with you. I'm loving this.
You
I'm all
mom.
About this. Seriously, yeah. And I love the fact that she was. And you know what? It must have been fantastic for her. You know, seeing her daughter kick ass would be amazing. So at this age, you're 17, 18. How did it make you feel as a woman? Taking on, now I know at the end of the day you had Katie Taylor in the background at this stage.
Absolutely.
As you know, it's safe to say not just our greatest sports person but one of the world's. She's she's in a league of her own. She's phenomenal. So you had that to kind of draw on.
Definitely.
But as a woman, boxing, something you'd never done, maybe you'd never thought of until the charity event, how does it make you feel?
To be honest, it made me feel...
Or how does it make you feel?
It still does. It makes me feel this confidence. And also like a strange kind of sexiness as well to it as well. That it's just like, it's just this confidence that comes from a place of don't bother messing. You know, like it's just, it takes all the bullshit out of, I think, interaction, especially with like guys and that. It's just like, oh, you know, I think there's a great confidence, I guess, you know, that comes from it.
And it's femininity in its most powerful form.
This is the thing. And I for so long I felt like I had to become masculine and kind of, especially being in the gym as the only woman, like I was kind of just dumbing down things and, you know, making sure that I was dressed a certain way and, you know, and going into boxing clubs, intimidating kind of environments. But just now I just go, there's nothing stronger than a woman. There's nothing stronger than the feminine energy. Like nothing. I mean, it makes, it breaks, it creates. Like there's nothing stronger than that. So when I really think about what makes me an excellent fighter is that feminine energy, you know?
Yeah.
That just goes, this is my territory. I'm not budging and I'm going to protect, you know? And just that kind of mentality that we all have as women. And that's what I want to bring to the mindful boxing and the movement meditations that I teach now. I like to bring women together. We can share what's going on. Set the intention. Why are you angry? What's making you feel the rage? Why don't you let yourself feel the rage? Give yourself the permission to feel that. Mm. Let's channel it. Get the boxing bag and let's go hell for leather. You know, and just showing actually how to use the technique, how to throw punches, how to do it, and just going, give yourself the permission now to be a wild woman for the next 45 minutes and let it all out, you know? And I think there's no more strength than that, in my opinion.
See, you're talking to somebody who gets it, right? I'm with you wholeheartedly. I know what you're saying, but I think people listening might be going, wait a second, I thought femininity was about being gentle and, you know, it's like feminine, you know, when you look at masculine energy, we've been bombarded with this idea that it's the masculine energy is the power and the feminine energy is the gentleness.
Yeah.
And while gentleness is important, it's the balance. When you really learn about feminine energy and the balance of the two, as you said, you know, there's so much more power behind that energy than people probably realize and has been taken from us. And it's, you know, the patriarchy have done quite a job on doing that. But it's time for us to reclaim that and what it actually means to be a woman.
Definitely. And I think, you know, I think it's such an exciting time now when we talk about gender, and that I feel like my mind is changing and my mind is opening to all of these new concepts and how we've just labeled this is femininity and this is masculinity. Mm. So you always say that with that caveat is like, we just label things and we've decided that this is what it is. But I think anyone who has been oppressed will have this unbelievable strength to give as a result. Do you know, like anyone who's been marginalized, anyone who's been oppressed in any way, I think there is a strength there, and that there's a reason why we were, you know, oppressed and marginalized in the first place, you know, and or why other groups have been. And I think that that's about, it's about reclaiming, like you said, about bringing the strength. And, you know, like I say women's circle, but I really include those who identify as women and those who choose to, like, you know, like don't subscribe to the gender binary, or and you know, and that's, I think there's so much, it's such an exciting time, and I feel like I'm constantly going, I'm wrong for thinking that, and I'm like, it's about like just kind of expanding our understandings of what gender is in the first place. But I do think there's a strength in women that I'm talking about, it that's separate to that, that's just, it's like a maternal, it's like the sea, you know, it's that, you know, it's just a nature that we have that we can just bring and fight with, you know, or protect with, or whatever we decide to, you know, whatever our you know, we want to tune into, like whether it's be a mother or whether it's, you know, create something, or, you know, just know that there is like a divinity in women, I feel. And I probably sound bonkers to the majority of people.
You don't sound
listening.
Bonkers to me.
Yeah.
I'm with you. And I suppose that's the thing as well. You know, it's recognizing that within all of us, regardless of gender, sexuality, that we are not all one thing. We're not all feminine energy or masculine. We're a combination. It's about making friends with both aspects of ourselves and fully understanding what it is. It's the yin and the yang, isn't it? So you were bitten by the bug and that was it. Okay, this is it now. I have found my thing. I know that we probably have many things, but this is a thing that I know I love. Yeah. Love how it makes me feel, and I'm good at it. Now, you've mentioned it a number of times, and clearly by the way you speak, you have done a lot of, I suppose, spiritual work, really. I know you've been on lots of different retreats. You've tried a lot of different things. You are a fan of meditation, and this movement meditation is fascinating. So how do they feel at the end of a class or a session with you?
I think, you know, I like, there's always a load of laughter, and that's what I wanted to achieve, was just have the crack, because I believe that the most spiritual thing anyone can do is just laugh.
Yeah.
And like in that is like my understanding of meditation is being okay with what is, you know, being okay with how you are right now. And if you're laughing at something, really laughing, you can't help but be okay with what is, do you know?
It's
it's like, so I just wanted to make it the most crack I could, and take all of the obsession that we have in gyms and in fitness classes with technique, that goes out the window. It's just about like really just feeling what you're doing and setting an intention. Like I kind of made I set an intention myself to set more intentions in my life, you know, and to do everything with more intention. And I think that brings me closer to the present than any other thing that, that I tried to do. Like I tried the Vipassana, I tried the, you know, breathe.
Will you explain that for listeners? And they're hearing about that. What did she just said? What is that?
Vipassana is like, it's a 10-day Buddhist retreat, and it's kind of, it started by a man from Burma, I believe, Asen Goenka. He started it, and it is about, a Vipassana is to see things as it is. Mm. And it's about like breathing and sitting and just, it was way too extreme for me. I think I did it way too young and naively. And I think,
what age are you?
22 when I did it.
Amazing. I haven't done it.
Yeah.
But I admire you massively.
Thank you.
Because it's not for the faint hearted.
No, it's not. It's not at all. And I don't think I'd be able to do another one now, to be honest.
It was silent.
Silent. Yeah.
Yeah. For how many days?
Oh, well, I actually only lasted 8. So.
I only lasted 8 full 8 days of pure silence.
I was like, get me a taxi, lads. I'm out. I'm like, I can't do it. I woke up one night and I had such a nice, like, again, you're looking at your feet the whole time. And I had this woman in the room with me. What was her name? Philippine, I think. She's from France. And again, no speaking, but I woke up, I think it was my body just being like, say something. Like I woke up singing Robbie Williams' Feel in the middle of the night, and her being like, what is going on? Do you know? And like, you only get like 6 hours sleep or something. So like, sleep is precious. And I'm there, I just want to feel like, and she's like, what is happening? Like, and we hadn't even made eye contact at this stage, you know? It was so funny. And then I laughed for a half hour, because I was like, God, it feels so good to laugh. But I think I was just, it was like my body's response to being told to be quiet for so long. I just went like, no, I'm going to take the opportunity maybe now to sing a song.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe it was your body, mind and soul just basically saying, you've come to where you needed to be.
Yeah,
now maybe. This is your release. Yeah. Now it's time to go.
Or maybe it was just me losing my mind on day six going like, this is too much. So I think... probably that was the extremist in me going, oh, I'll be able for 10 days, no bother. Send me to Morocco, like, grand, you know, feck's sake. I think that was one of those, probably a blind spot of mine to go, let's just go right into it. And that's something I have to be mindful of in everything that I do. Like, okay. When I talk about...
Because
like,
you're all or nothing.
All or nothing. Yeah. And it catches me. And right. I think I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But it's really just... It's just me going, I'm going to be the best at this. Yeah. Oh, meditation? Send me to the hardest one. Let me become a monk. Do you know, it's just so ridiculous because, I mean, it wasn't like it was helpful. I learned techniques. I learned that. But I don't think I was actually meditating. I think the whole time I was just like, get me out of here. Jesus Christ. I was like, how much longer? And they're all, you know, older people who had a wisdom and a calmness about them. And I was just dying to get out of there. Now, parts of it were brilliant. And I did feel I had a bit of a breakthrough on day 3-4 where I was observing all of the insecurities in myself.
Yeah.
Going so much insecurity and so much baggage. And because your brain, I felt, because I was silent, it was like things felt a lot deeper for me. Like visually, I felt like I had like actual baggage of insecurities on my back. And I was like physically in the room, just like pretending to take a bag off.
Oh,
like,
wow,
you know,
yeah,
I think,
yeah.
Again, you're just, I'm not
you're
sure.
Visual, so that worked for you.
I'm not sure whether it was intense boredom or whether it was actually a breakthrough. I think it might have been a breakthrough of sorts. For some people, sitting down and meditating, sometimes that's not going to work for everyone. And
exactly.
I think there's like a, I don't know, like a kind of, I thought that was the only way. That was my naivety. It was like, that's the only way. But sometimes I watch my dad walk the dog.
Yeah.
And like the way he just like will like just slowly move and like just, that's meditation. Do you know?
Yeah. Mindful
like,
walking.
Mindful walking. Even go out and look at the sea. Or like what I said about like looking at the stars. And just a reminder of like, you're only here for a little while.
What's your quote again?
Yeah, we're all just a grain of shite.
Okay.
So, that's it. Like, have a tattooed. No, I don't. But
not yet.
Not yet. But that's meditation, you know, like just being all right with what's happening now.
Yeah.
And I think there is such a, you have to have the technique and you have to, all the focus. And I just take all of that out. Like some people meditating might be literally just having a glass of water and just
being present with it.
On glass
yeah,
of water.
Totally.
Yeah.
How does your spiritual practice enrich your boxing?
That's a hard question.
Or does it?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure it does. I think for a while, I guess the intention setting is important, you know, and I do it now.
And
before.
Is this, I'm going to win?
Yeah, like more so just what am I letting go of today when I'm physically moving? Because I find that.
Okay, wow.
I find that like I am so quick. I think it's the kind of the knife edge of, it's the opposite side of being able to be very aware of your thoughts is sometimes that I create a narrative that maybe doesn't need to be there of like, okay, well, this happened to me then and that this could be what's the trigger is today. And I go too deep into things sometimes. So that's that, like what I've found in like managing anxiety and managing like panic and stuff like that, that I've experienced over the years, just move your body and stop the chatter for a second, you know?
Yeah.
And I think like boxing has been therapeutic for me in that way, because rather than going, oh, and that was really difficult for me and I'm processing that now, and oh, that was a trigger, so maybe that's why I feel a little bit less likely, you know, or less open today or whatever, you know, whatever sort of narrative you're trying to tell yourself, it's like, actually just have your breakfast and go out and sweat for a bit and see how you feel then, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's and that sounds very reductive and it's not for everyone, but for me, I know that I can become like very locked in trying to analyze my thoughts. And that's after years of doing it and having to do it in order to recover. I still find like something might have happened in work and then I'm like, God, that's playing on my mind and I'm processing that and that's been quite, I'm experiencing grief. It's like, actually, no, you just need to sweat. Like you've just been sitting down for too long and you're hungry, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that for me has been really helpful in just setting an intention just before I work out, what am I letting go of? Right, that was pretty hard. Cool. So try and visualize letting go of the blocks that's, you know, that's inside you now, you know. that's kind of...
And that's your life's practice now, letting go, surrendering.
Yeah, I think so. And just getting okay, getting closer to being okay
with the bumps in the road and the imperfections.
Yeah.
You're 25, as we've mentioned, and you don't really, I believe, reach your peak in terms of boxing till you're in your 30s.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
So you've a lot of time left.
Yeah, thankfully, yeah.
Yeah. And going pro is something that you're considering?
Yeah.
Down the line?
Definitely, down the line. I would love to. It's always been a dream, and it was always kind of the dream for me when I started amateur boxing. I just know that my fitness works better over... I'm more of an endurance athlete. I always have been, you know, like I just prefer like long distance running. I prefer marathon running to... Like I wouldn't go out and do a 10K, but I'd happily train for a marathon.
And, all right, you know, well, yeah.
I just prefer that type of fitness, which, you know, amateur boxing, as you know, is 3 3-minute rounds and it's very much point scoring and you're kind of tagging your opponent.
Intense.
It's intense and it's cruel. It's such a cruel sport. And I think in ways a lot harder than pro. Whereas pro is 10 rounds for win, you know, and 2 minute rounds, and you're just, you're stalking and your feet are planted and you're selecting your shots a lot more strategically, I think.
So that'll suit you more.
It would, because it's more, you kind of come into yourself over the rounds. Well, I find anyway, in like sparring and that, I just get better as it goes on. Now, I haven't been properly sparring. I haven't been disciplined with my training in a while, and I think that was COVID knocked me back a bit. Us all back.
Yeah.
But I mean, it would be a dream to have a couple of pro fights, definitely.
And are you holding back for any particular reason?
No, I'm not really. I think I'm working and I'm trying to juggle a few things, and I think writing my thesis last year really...
Well, that's
just...
it. We haven't even spoken about all the stuff that you've done. So you said you're a high achiever. You did a brilliant Leaving Cert. Then you went on to Trinity.
Yeah.
You're a law graduate from Trinity College, and then you went on to do a master's.
Yeah, I got an MPhil in International Peace Studies.
So that's Masters of Philosophy.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm pretending like I know what it is.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's I did.
And you just finished that?
Yeah, I just finished it. I literally just graduated there.
What can't you do?
2 months ago. Lots. Like lots. I'm a master of making it look all easy, but it's not.
No, you're incredibly impressive, but also wonderfully humble, which is extremely endearing.
Thank you.
So you've all of that stuff going on. So where do you... I know the classic question. Where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years' time? But do you have... Are you someone that plans or not?
Not at all. Well,
okay.
I mean,
you're all about being in the present moment.
Yeah, I mean,
all we have is now.
I don't know about that. I think I'm just kind of like always trying to juggle loads of different things at once. To be honest, I am unsure where I'll go next. You know, I really enjoyed working last year in politics. I was working in the Shannon with Frances Black, who's just an incredible woman. Just an incredible woman. I learned so much from her. So I was writing her speeches and doing some of the legislation there.
Oh wow, well done.
And just loved her.
She's a gorgeous person.
She's amazing and just such a good heart. And I think there's plenty of really great women in Irish politics, like Lynn Ruane and Asmary Higgins and Eileen Flynn. Like I love them all. I just think they're brilliant. But I don't know where I'm going to go, whether it's law or politics or I do want to focus on bringing more women into the movement meditation and focusing my energy on, you know, inspiring more.
Yeah.
If I can, where I can, because it's always conversations like these. It's always, you know, going into schools. That's the stuff that I always feel great after, and it fills me. And I know that, you know, I mightn't reach, you know, half the room, but half of them are listening and somebody in there is being spoken to the way that they need to. And, that's what I want to do more of. That's what I absolutely adore. And I'd love to do more of.
You're an amazing person. I will be very proudly saying I met her, I spoke to her, and I'll be continuing to follow your journey and whatever you do. Thank you for taking time to be here today. I really appreciate it. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I obviously did. And if you did, please share it with your friends or family or pop it up on social media. Or, of course, you can support the pod in all the usual ways by clicking follow, leaving a rating or a little comment as well. Thank you so much for listening to Ready to Be Real.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.